From Austin Film Festival and PRI, this is On Story, a look inside the creative process from today's leading writers and filmmakers. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. This week's On Story, we'll hear from comedy veteran Ali LeRoy, whose longtime collaboration with comedian Chris Rock resulted in Everybody Hates Chris and Down to Earth.
The joke is the unexpected thing. That's it. It's just the thing that you say, you know, that someone doesn't expect you to say at the end of things that made sense.
And later we'll discuss young adult fiction with the screenwriters behind The Fault in Our Stars and CW's The 100.
As long as the emotions are legitimate and come from a real place, that to me is the most important thing when doing YA.
On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI, we'll be back in a moment. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. Ali LeRoy is an Emmy Award-winning writer, director, and producer, best known for his collaboration with comedian Chris Rock that resulted in Everybody Hates Chris and the films Head of State and Down to Earth. Comedian Dave Buckman sat down with LeRoy to discuss his transition from stand-up comedy to screenwriting and the perseverance required to make it as a writer. Clips of Head of State, courtesy of DreamWorks LLC. Clips of Everybody Hates Chris, courtesy of CBS Studios, Inc. Clips of The Chris Rock Show, courtesy of Home Box Office, a division of Time Warner Entertainment Company, LP. Clips of Survivor's Remorse, courtesy of Starz Entertainment, LLC. Clips of Pootie Tang, courtesy of Paramount Pictures Corporation.
What were some of those early stand-up years like? What was your act like? Do you remember any of your...
I was always kind of, you know, I skewed observational because when I was growing up, I was a big, you know, everybody was a Richard Pryor fan. I was a George Carlin fan.
Me too.
Right? So I was always fascinated with the words themselves, you know, not necessarily always the experience, because a lot of times George Carlin wasn't talking about, you know, experience in this big way. He wasn't really personal, you know? Like I said, it was observational. And, you know, Pryor was extremely, you know, incredibly personal.
How did the experience of joke writing inform kind of your later work as a writing for characters and stories?
The joke is the unexpected thing. That's it. It's just the thing that you say, you know, that someone doesn't expect you to say at the end of things that made sense. That's all.
Okay.
Yeah, you're writing a joke and then, you know, everything you're saying, that's set up. Everything you're saying makes sense. Then you say something that doesn't make sense.
Quick diversion.
Right.
Yeah.
And the thing about it is so what can be elusive about it is, you know, the purest form of joke writing and joke writers, Stephen Wright, Rodney Dangerfield, Henny Youngman,
mm-hmm.
one-liners.
Sure.
Set up, punchline. It's the most efficient form of joke telling on earth, right? I'm going to make you laugh in about 37 seconds. Then you start getting into this more, you know, involved, detailed storytelling thing where, you know, you start going through the ins and outs of an experience and saying what you thought and how you responded to it. And so, you know, that's on the far end of it. So what we do as writers, and, you know, what I do is someplace in between. You kind of try and wrap that up into some version of experience where you're telling the big story that has these rises and falls and ups and downs. And then you're in a conversation with somebody where things, you know, kind of present as you're the setup, I'm the punchline. And sometimes people do it for themselves. So, you know, there's a lot of ways to approach it, but there is a lot of craft in terms of understanding how it works so you can make your choice about how you want to move through it. Larry David in Curb Your Enthusiasm is the walking punchline. You know, life is the setup.
Yes.
Right? Walking into circumstances where I would imagine a person would do one thing and then I do something else. But it's not necessarily in the dialogue always.
So you start writing for other people as mm-hmm. well as while you're still doing stand-up, you're still writing for other people as well?
So people say funny is funny. That's not true. I've never believed that to be the case, because a lot of times when you're talking about comedy, comedy doesn't get comedy because people don't understand how it works.
How does it work?
Well, I'll put it to you like this. From the outside looking in, people laugh at what they laugh at. Funny is saying like an engine is an engine. Okay, yeah, tell that to the guy that built the engine, right? So, you know, in terms of how you want to get the laugh, that's why there is farce and satire and slapstick and parody, you know, all of the gross out humor. These are all forms of comedy, right? Yeah, every Adam Sandler movie, somebody's getting kicked in the balls. How is it funny every time? Well, because he knows how to do it. That's what it is. Funny is a very distinct and defined set of practices and ideas that you put into effect to get a desired result. That's what it is. You got to be a technician to do this.
Yeah, the context has so much to do with it, too.
It's everything. You know, where are you when you're doing the thing? What's the circumstance? Who are the people? What do we believe about them? What do you bring to the experience? All of that goes into the laugh. Absolutely 100% all of it. And the best comedian understands all of those things. He knows where he is. He knows how he sees other people. They know how they see him. Right, you take all of these factors into consideration, and then that's how you get the laugh. It's not funny as funny. It is, you know, it's surgery. It's surgery.
So you start working with Bernie Mac early
yes.
on. What do you remember about Bernie Mac before we knew Bernie Mac?
When I first met Bernie, he was doing what I would call joke book jokes. You know, guy walks into a bar, sits at the counter. Another guy is sitting there, you know, that kind of stuff,
sure.
right? And he would do them in his act until he came off the road. You know, he eventually stopped touring. And he always made them work because he just understood that, again, he knew that people liked Bernie Mac, right? People thought Bernie Mac was funny. So he knew that he could take a joke that was 25 years old, put a spin on it, you know, he would change the people in it to fit his circumstance because everybody hasn't heard every joke, right? So if there's a joke about doctors that a group of Jewish people used to tell each other, he can take that joke and put it into a context of black people, repopulate the whole scenario, tell a joke, and make it work. You know, because you got differences in terms of culture, you got differences in terms of income, where does a doctor work? Again, it's all that surgery, and he knew how to do that. So he'd have plenty of material that was, you know, about his family. And when I first met him, he was starting to form those things.
What can you tell us a little bit about writing for other people in their voice, writing stand-up for other people?
You write what you think is funny, and then you hand it to somebody and let them find what they want to do. So that's back to funny is funny. No, I write a joke that I could deliver. And then, you know, Bernie or Chris Rock or, you know, Roseanne or whoever it is looks at it and goes, oh, man, that's funny. Okay. But in order for me to do this joke, mm-hmm. it's got to be this. And so that's songwriting. You know, that's like changing a key, you know, doing a different arrangement. The song is still the song. Right. But in order for it to work for my voice, I have to do this with it. I got to change the tempo. I got to change the key. I got to shift these chords around. Still the same song. Right. So when you're writing for other people, best case scenario, you're writing what you think is funny, and then they're taking the bits that they can use and putting that into their arsenal.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
So you transitioned from stand-up into writing.
Yes.
What was that decision like? Was that hard a decision to make?
So at that point, I had just been married for like 4 or 5 years. I had been on the road, traveling the country, performing at arenas, with in auditoriums with Bernie Mac before the Kings of Comedy, right? He is not, you know, the household name. There's no television show. There's no HBO. There's none of that. And he's regularly selling out theaters anywhere from a couple of thousand up to 5,000 seats.
Wow.
Like, that's how he's making his living. So I'm touring with him doing that. And I had met Chris Rock a number of years earlier when he was early in the stand-up scene in New York. So he was just starting to kind of hit his stride. He had just done Bring the Pain, mm-hmm. The HBO thing, and they were talking to him about, you know, doing a television show. So I'm on the road with Bernie. Chris calls me from New York and asked me to come write for him on his television show. So I was doing both for, I don't know, 18 months, maybe almost 2 years, from 95 until about 98, something like that. And it was too much. My family was in Chicago. My wife, I just had a baby. Chris's show was shooting in New York. So I was kind of living there. And then on the weekends, I was going on the road with Bernie. Hmm. So, you know, trying to find some time to get home. And literally, I could not keep it up. And the decision that I made was that I felt like a couple of things. My stand-up was, I felt it was suffering. Because part of being funny is an invention. You know, you got to think it's funny. You got to feel fresh. You got to feel excited about what you're doing so that other people feel it. Because if you're bored, they're bored.
Yeah.
And I didn't have a lot of opportunity to work on my own material because I just had the weekends to, you know, go out, do a show. And I could do it. And some people are great at that. Some people can do the same act forever. And they do it with the same vitality as when they wrote it 20 years earlier. They just don't stop. And I was not able to do that. So I made the decision to come off the road and just write full time. And the reason that I made that decision was that I was a good stand-up. I mean, I'm not going to, you know, take any credit away from myself. I was solid. I was strong. I was funny. No two ways about it. You don't work in front of 3,000 or 5,000 people and not be good. I was good. However, I felt like there were people who loved it more than I did.
Yeah.
Right? That they couldn't wait to get on stage. I never once told anybody that I killed. Even when I did, I never said that to anybody.
How come?
You know, that's not what it was about for me.
What was it about?
I loved being able to execute the ideas that I had and execute them well.
Yeah.
And I loved getting the response. But I didn't necessarily need to tell somebody else that. Because, you know, in my world, or at least the way it worked for me, it's like, if I really killed, somebody will tell somebody else. I don't need to tell them. They'll tell me.
It's more about the relationship with the audience.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, if you're killing, they will tell you that. You don't have to say it. Yeah. They'll tell you that you killed. They won't stop telling people that you killed. Yeah. If that's what really happened. If you're running around telling everybody that you killed, I don't know. You know, it's a choice. And so that wasn't where my head was. And so I didn't feel like I loved it like the people who really loved it, whether they did that thing or did not do that thing. But I did love writing. And I also, from a career perspective, I was making a practical choice, which was, I can go out on this road and get in this long line of people clamoring for the attention of people in these theaters, or I can do this other thing, which is I can create and be behind the content that those people are trying to be a part of. It's a shorter line.
And it's pretty successful early on. You guys won 2 Emmys.
Yeah,
early.
We did okay.
Yeah.
We got some nominations. We won once, twice, and you know, it's weird how time is. But in Chris's show, it was, I always equated us to, you know, if you're a little bit older, if you've done some wiki research and you know what your show of shows is,
sure.
Then I kind of felt like we were like that.
On Story is a part of a growing number of programs in Austin Film Festival's On Story project, including the On Story PBS series, the On Story radio program and podcast, and the On Story book series. To find out more about On Story and Austin Film Festival, visit onstory.tv or austinfilmfestival.com. On Story from Austin Film Festival and Public Radio International will be back in a moment. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. We're back with Emmy Award-winning writer and comedian Ali LaRoy. Most recently, LaRoy was a writer and executive producer for the Starz original series, Survivor's Remorse. When we left off, LaRoy was discussing his transition from being a successful stand-up comedian to screenwriter.
In our writer's room in 96, 97, you know, of course, Chris was heading things up. There was Wanda Sykes, Louis C.K., myself, Lance Crowther, who would play Pootie Tang, who works alongside Wanda on a lot of her projects now.
Pootie Tang, welcome to the show, man.
Thanks, baby.
Now, Pootie Tang on my show. It is so good to see you, Pootie Tang. Now, you must be doing a promotional tour or something.
Yeah.
Now, Pootie, I was wondering, what happened to you down by the Cutty Stye?
Oh, Chris, that Cutty Stye beat was all right? I was just down there, you know, tying in a cloud.
Really? Because everybody said you was crying on a Tammy.
No, my Damien. That's a water tie to the Samacow.
There was a guy who people probably don't know so well. His name is Jeff Stilson, who was a producer and writer that worked for a number of years with David Letterman. Mm-hmm. He produced and shot a bunch of stuff for Ali G, Sacha Baron Cohen. Mm-hmm. And he was also one of the guys behind the Osbournes. I'm just saying, like, the pool was deep.
Yeah. So after Chris Rock... Uh-huh. Show, what comes next for you?
So after the Chris Rock show, we actually did, we did Down to Earth while we were doing the show.
Down to Earth is the, you guys remade Heaven Can Wait?
Yes, exactly.
Right.
Directed by the Weitz brothers, written by Chris, myself, Louie, and Lance. We did Down to Earth.
What is that like to adapt such an iconic film for a new audience?
Well, I don't want to say easy. However, it's not different than what I was saying earlier about, you know, the song being the song. Chris just takes the landscape and he goes, okay, you know, a guy comes back from dead and he's moving through the world in a particular way. I'm going to leave the guy white, but I'm going to make the guy that dies black. And just by virtue of doing that, and then you fill in all of the, you know, you fill in all of the cultural reference points, you fill in all the specific experiences, and now you got a comedy. You know, you've taken two things that don't belong next to each other, and, you know, and there you go. So, yeah, it's just like doing a rock version of a soul song.
Let's go back to Pootie Tang.
I'm
very curious about where Pootie Tang came from, what that process was like putting it together, and what was that like filming it?
So Pootie Tang was a sketch on the Chris Rock show.
Okay.
Written and conceived by Louis C.K., right? And Lance played Pootie Tang. And while we were in production or about to go in on Down to Earth, Chris had a great idea, which was, if they're spending X amount of money on this thing, maybe it'll give us a little more money to do this other little thing, right? I mean, he was kind of like at the, you know, he was having a superpower moment right then. The show was doing well. He was getting a lot of attention. You know, why not try to do a few things? So Pootie Tang had gotten, you know, some notice on the show. So he kind of handed it off to Louis to shoot, like, I think it was like a $3 million budget. To shoot Pootie Tang. And so off Louis went with Lance and, you know, all his crazy ideas. So when he finished, Pootie Tang came in. His original cut of the movie was about 2.5 hours.
What?
Yeah. It was about 2.5 hour cut of Pootie Tang.
Oh, my gosh. I can't even imagine.
So at the same time, we had turned in a cut of Down to Earth with the Weitz brothers directing. And so they got this testing process that they do for films.
Sure.
Right? So they tested Down to Earth, and the scores were not great. Mm-hmm. It was like maybe like high 50s, low 60s, something like that. You know, 100 being best, and that is, you know, if you're in class, that's a D-minus, right? So not that great. So we were talking back and forth with the studio, and we were trying to find creative ways to get them to give us more money to maybe do some reshoots. There was some negotiations with the directors, the Weitz brothers. So Chris was really fighting hard to get his vision of what the movie would be up on screen. It didn't necessarily sync with Paul and Chris, and I mean, they were great, great guys, but just culturally speaking, I don't think they really necessarily recognized and appreciated the touchstones of what would appeal to Chris's audience,
right?
You know, coming from an American Pie background. You know, it was certainly funny and successful, but sometimes you just miss that nuance. So we were able to get the studio to sign off on doing some reshoots for Down to Earth. Now, at the same time, you know, Louis has his 2.5 hour cut of Pootie Tang. That was tested. It tested at a 13. That's an actual number. I'm not making that up. So we had some conversations with the studio at the time, Sherry Lansing, and they called me because we had retested and reshot some things with Down to Earth and eventually got the score up from like this low 60s up to almost 90. It was like an 88 or 89. It's like, now we're talking. Okay, great. So they're like, okay, do that with Pootie Tang. And then I got them to agree to do some reshoots, which were done like with a little handheld Canon GL4 mini DV.
which parts were the reshoots?
We did some riot stuff. We reshot some stuff with Wanda because we put these like these little interstitial story pieces in. Right, all of that stuff
Wanda
was reshoot stuff.
To the
yeah, all of that.
Pootie Tang, hey man, you going to the Biggest Shorty party tomorrow, man? I guess you're wondering, who is Biggest Shorty?
Biggest Shorty.
I'm Biggie Shorty.
Biggie, baby.
Let me tell you about me and Pootie Tang.
Seven times.
Since the very day we met, I knew Pootie was to be my man.
Yeah, baby.
I knew all I had to do was wait.
What a time.
And one day, all that would catch up with Pootie, and he would be mine.
Hey, man, you going to the Biggest Shorty party tomorrow, man?
The J.B. Smoove voiceover was something that we conceived of in the edit room, and I wrote that with J.B. and put that in. And so then we took these elements, we took some stock footage and put it in. We did all this stuff because they wouldn't give us any money.
Right.
You know, they gave us more time, but they wouldn't give us any money. And, you know, eventually we went back out and tested it, and we got it up from a 13 to a 39. Which I'm quite proud of. It tripled. I don't know if anybody else has tripled the score of a film.
Usually there's not that much room.
Right. I did it. So that's kind of my bizarre Pootie Tang story.
Wow. Thank you for sharing that.
You're welcome.
And let's talk a little bit about Head of State as
okay.
well.
Yes.
As long as we're in the Chris Rock au revoir.
Uh-huh. The original film that we looked at when we were talking about doing Head of State was a Robert Redford film. Called a candidate.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Oh, I didn't even make those connections.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Candidate and Rocky.
And Rocky. How did Rocky?
Well, because Chris, you know, Chris, he's really a romantic guy. You would not know that from him talking, but he really is a romantic guy, right? When he talks about Rocky, the thing that strikes him, he said this a number of times, the last line of the movie is, I love you. And the last scene of The Candidate is like, what do we do now?
Yeah.
Right? And so it was just this whole notion of, you know, a guy wanting to be in a relationship, a guy swimming upstream, you know, in murky and unfamiliar waters and not knowing the things that he's not supposed to do. And what happens if that works out? You know, it's kind of like the notion that we went in on. And I would honestly say, if you go back and you watch Head of State now, it all happened. You know, everything from the white people voter rush to the racism to the lowball dirty tactics, and it's all in there.
You said that we needed somebody who can help the party. Now, how in the hell does this guy help the party?
I'm glad you asked. See? The United States is changing. Well, America is changing. Inside of 20 years, well, you know the numbers, 20% black, 21% Asian, 39% Hispanic, the minorities will be the majority. Now, the smartest thing we can do is be the first party to nominate a minority for president.
How about a cripple?
I don't think so, Charlie. Now, we'll lose, of course, but the minorities will be happy.
Like, I mean, it's really kind of prescient in the way that it happened. You know, we just were kind of going at it. Like, we didn't want to make, and this is another thing, we didn't want to make a black president movie, because that's the easy thing. Right, the black president movie is I'm in charge. That's a Rodney Dangerfield movie,
right?
I'm in charge, I do wacky stuff, you know, whatever. You know, that's the Marx Brothers or whatever. You know, we want to do a black candidate movie. Like, how do you get from here to there? Because sure. That's where all the work was. That's where all the comedy is. When you learn what the machinery is and how the system works, how people stop you, what do you have to do to overcome it? You know, what are identity politics? Like all of that. That's where we are now. It's all about the process and not about the win or the lose.
Wow. And then you transitioned from film into TV mm-hmm. with Everybody Hates Chris.
Right.
What can you tell us about the process of putting that show together and having such a successful run, what that's like? And
I don't know that Chris was interested in doing the show.
Okay.
Fox Network at the time had Malcolm in the Middle.
Mm-hmm.
And the other reference point for that type of story was the Wonder Years.
Right.
Right. And so they just kind of felt like they wanted to do something in that space from a Chris Rock perspective. Chris Rock did not come to those initial meetings. I went. we worked together and we've always had a great rapport. We've been friends for, I don't know, 30 years now. So, you know, I went and I sat down and heard what they had to say and, you know, didn't talk a lot. And then I went back to him. I was like, this could be kind of cool. So we started
kind of. How did
you
sell him?
Yeah. Well, here's what I did. I mean, I talked about that it was Wonder Years, that it was Malcolm in the Middle. You know, this would be a black kid. We hadn't seen a black kid in that type of nuanced storytelling. Black kids were, you know, it was sitcom-y. It was always loud. You know, three camera, multicam. That was really how black people were treated in the comedy space. Yeah. And I say treated like it's a bad thing, but that was the platform that we were kind of given. So that was a new way of kind of approaching the comedy. So we talked about it. We came up with some ideas. And originally, the approach that we were going to take was that it would be a kid who was, you know, a preteen or whatever in the early 90s, right before Bill Clinton became president.
Okay.
We were going to do that because, culturally speaking, that was a big shift in the country.
Yeah.
Right? They called Bill Clinton a black president. You know, we had been a few years into, like, a domination in pop culture by hip hop. You know, P. Diddy is big. Hip hop is a thing. There are lots of black millionaires. There are young black people who have grown up knowing rich black people. It's like, it's not a thing. Oprah's famous. There's a lot of reference points for young black people in terms of how they see themselves in the culture. So we thought, oh, this is a great place to start a story about a young black kid. We talked about it. We had a lot of great ideas. And this is a quote. We were in my office one day, and Chris literally says, you know, if we want to get this on TV, the kid should probably be me. That's why it's Chris.
Wow.
Then we shifted everything like 10 years back.
To the early 80s. Early
and made it, you know, a version of his story. Because, you know, I mean, if you listen to him talk, you know, he talks about how rough it was growing up in Bed-Stuy. And then he was able to tell all of the, you know, the stuff about the culture. We were still going to situate it there. But the best thing about being able to use Chris in the Wonder Years, there's this guy, a character that they create. Daniel Stern did a voiceover. You really don't know who that is.
Right.
It's just somebody you made up and they're following the story because you get to do that. You know, and Malcolm is Malcolm. He's talking to the camera. But for us to throw all of the stuff at this little kid that we threw at him.
Oh, my gosh.
It's okay because you know it works out.
Jeez, what was that?
At school, Caruso tortured me every chance he got.
Battering. A D. They're packing heavy. Come on, man, let's just go.
No. I'm getting tired of him.
If I had a brick, I'd have hit him. Maybe he didn't see who threw it. Now, where were these guys when Tupac got shot?
He never wins.
It's going to work out.
Yeah.
And literally, Everybody Hates Chris was just a joke.
Yeah.
He's like, everybody loves Raymond, everybody hates Chris. That was that. That's just Chris being Chris.
That's great. That's awesome. The one thing I want to talk about was about Survivor's Remorse. It's
okay.
A lot more mature.
Yeah.
A little sexier.
Right.
Than most of your other work.
Right.
How has that transitioned for you? Was that a transition for you? Was that different for you?
Well, I mean, it's certainly a space that I want to work in. I mean, you know, I've done a lot of family stuff, you know, but I'm also a grown guy with a family. I've had a ton of grown guy experiences with other grown people and grown women. And yeah, I mean, just at a certain point, you just tap out on this version of your experience. You know, you just do.
Yeah.
Because other people, because also the nature of it changes, right? So if I'm 35 talking about family, my reach back to being a young person in a family and even my experience as an adult, you know, as a partner in a family with a wife or whatever is different than, you know, 20 years later when the cultural landscape has changed and even how the family functions in society has changed. So you might be talking about this insular experience of what it means to be inside the house, but you're not talking about this more involved experience of what it means to be inside the culture. Right. So that's how the nature of writing a family show can change. So now, you know, you go from Everybody Hates Chris to Modern Family to Blackish because the world around them has changed. So the people inside the room need to change, you know. And then as a writer, sometimes you're just moving through the space in a particular way and you need to talk about a different aspect of your experience. So Survivor's Remorse is still a family show.
I love my job. I didn't go to school and study for all these years just to get married and quit.
Well, you are atypical with that. I mean, most girls marry a guy like my brother, can't wait to quit. And that's if they ever even get anything started. Usually, their job is to get knocked up as soon as humanly possible and then negotiate about the upbringing of the baby to be. Clearly, you're not that type. I dare say you don't have a thought bone in your body.
Well, you might need one, because these girls around here are serious.
I'm telling you, all these ball players do is get with these girls, have babies, and pay child support and keep it moving. But Cam, he's the marrying kind. So how long y'all been married?
30 years. Before the babies. Impressive.
Not at that time. Her mama come from a long line of fathers, and they don't play that.
It's still absolutely 100% a family show, but it just comes from now the kid is a multimillionaire.
Right.
And he's famous. But he's still got a mother who does this. He's still got a brother who does that, a sister who's crazy, and, you know, these other experiences. And it's still about what happens inside this house and inside this family. But the information about how they move through the world has changed.
How do you take something that's tragic and make it entertaining?
I mean, to start with, if you have the opportunity to talk to anybody that's funny, what you will probably find yourself talking to is a person who has some of the most tragic stories you can possibly come up with. Comedy is a survival technique. You know, it is a way of being alive in this space. It is a way. It's like the reason that I'm laughing about this is because if I don't, I might stab somebody. Right. That's the thing. So that's what we're doing all the time, is taking things that are tragic and things that are sad and taking things that are unfortunate and putting a spin on it and making it into something that we can laugh at. So here's the thing I believe, and it's a simple thing. Do one thing well. Right. If you want to be a stand up, be the greatest stand up you want to be. But you can't be a stand up trying to be a writer. It can't be a ruse. You know, can't be a scam. As soon as I get done with this, I'm getting this room. And then no. If you're going to engage, then engage 100%.
On Story is part of a growing number of programs in Austin Film Festival's On Story project, including the On Story PBS series, the On Story radio program and podcast, and the On Story book series. To find out more about On Story and Austin Film Festival, visit onstory.tv or austinfilmfestival.com. On Story from Austin Film Festival and Public Radio International. We'll be back in a moment.
We'll be right back.
This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. Young adult fiction has exploded in popularity over recent years, and while the stories are centered around teenagers and are marketed to that demographic, a recent study found that more than half of YA readers are actually adults. Professor Carol Hoffner spoke with The Spectacular Now co-writer Michael H. Weber and CW's The 100 writer-producer Charmaine DeGreat to discuss the draw of YA stories and the process behind adapting novels to the screen. Clips of The 100, courtesy of Warner Brothers Television, the CW Network, and CBS Television Studios. Clips of The Fault in Our Stars and Paper Towns, courtesy of 20th Century Fox Film Corporation. Clips of The Spectacular Now, courtesy of TSN Ventures, LLC.
Did The Spectacular Now come to you, or did you find it?
I grew up before there was a YA label, so I loved the movies of John Hughes and early Cameron Crowe stuff like Fast Times at Ridgemont High and American Graffiti, which I guess those would have been YA if that designation had existed back then.
Huckleberry Finn would have been YA.
Right, right. It's, yeah. So, and it's funny, we've since adapted books that are YA in some countries and not in others. So it's a weird, it's very strange territory to territory what's considered YA. But I always love those sort of coming of age stories. And Scott and I were looking for that type of story when our studio executive at Searchlight that we had worked with on 500 gave us the book, The Spectacular Now. And the book had been shortlisted for the National Book Award. And I'm a book nerd, and I had never heard of it. It was not a bestseller or anything. And we both loved it. It just felt like it came from a real place. So that was our first YA experience. It took 5 years to get that movie made, and it started as a studio film and became an independent film, like a true independent film where we had to raise all the money. But in those intervening years, the script almost served as a calling card for us, where it helped us get the job to adapt Fault in Our Stars and other things based off of The Spectacular Now, which for years was basically just a sample.
Charmaine, can you talk a little bit about your involvement in the show? I know you have so many different kinds of credits on this particular show, from story editor to written by to producer,
to staff
executive
writer,
yeah. All of this, and how that sort of evolved.
Well, I started as a staff writer, and that was season 3. And from there, you know, it was story editor, and Jason Rothenberg, who again is the creator, likes to promote from within. And so it just sort of, I stayed with the show, and it's been 4 years now, and I kind of just worked my way up to supervising producer.
How do you make the internal external?
I think in television, we have a little bit more luxury because we have the luxury of time. And so when we have those sort of internal conflicts and we're developing characters and we're giving them impossible choices and finding the sort of moral gray area and allowing them to make mistakes and all of those things, and sort of we have 10, 13, 16 episodes to sort of explore that. What we tend to do is put them in environments and put them in conflicts that we can kind of see them make choices and make mistakes and, you know, the fallout of that, and then how they deal with the consequences of their choices.
I feel the sun on my face. I see trees all around me, the scent of wildflowers on a breeze. It's so beautiful. In this moment, I'm not stranded in space. It's been 97 years since a nuclear apocalypse killed everyone on Earth, leaving the planet simmering in radiation. Fortunately, there were survivors. 12 nations had operational space stations at the time of the bombs. There is now only the Ark, one station forged from the many.
But yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Like, I think television is changing in that way, and just in terms of, you know, how we explore character. I think we get a little edgier and a little grittier now in network than we did before. So
our goal is always to use as much of the book as possible. Mm-hmm. You know, in terms of taking things that are internal and making them external, our first choice would always be dialogue. you know, have it come out organically between characters who are communicating. But if need be, we'll come up with a device. It's not the most original idea in the world, but we open and close Spectacular Now with Miles Teller's character writing an essay.
Dear Dean of Admissions, my name is Sutter Keeley, and up until yesterday, I had the best girlfriend in the world. I know I probably shouldn't say right there, but I'm sorry. I have to. Like, we had this connection, seriously. Everybody knew us. Everybody loved us. We were a force to be reckoned with. And I'm not gonna say that we're the life of every party, but we were. We were the life of every party. Before Cassidy, I wasn't much of a relationship guy. But once we started hooking up, that all changed.
Morning.
I liked her. A lot.
In the beginning of the movie, he kind of abandons the essay. He doesn't give a shit about the future or finishing this essay. We learn that was a way to take a lot of really interesting stuff that was internal in the book when we're getting in this character's head and find a way to make it convey information to the audience about what this character is feeling and thinking, but hopefully in an entertaining way and not a way that feels like an information dump. In terms of something we invented, you know, the ending of The Spectacular Now, if you've read the book, is super bleak. The main character is in a dive bar drinking with older barflies and then stumbles out of the bar and is wandering along the side of a highway as cars pass and thinking about how he might slip into the cracks in the pavement, and that's the end of the book. So we wrote a scene where he goes after Shailene Woodley's character, and the ending is not necessarily they walk off into the sunset, but there is character growth there. Because here's a character who for most of the movie has, when he's not drinking himself into a stupor, is running away from love. And by the end of it, he's actually running towards it. And we don't necessarily know if she's going to take him back or if it will even work out, but there's a shred of hope there. And we liked that ending, which was our invention, a little more than the ending of the book. You know, it's interesting, we were lucky. The book later became a bestseller once the movie came out, which we were so happy for Tim Tharp because he's a phenomenal writer and deserves to a larger audience. If that book had been a bestseller when we first got a hold of it, we might not have been able to change the ending like that.
I think what I particularly liked about that ending was that you could write your own happy ending if you so chose as the audience. Also in The Spectacular Now, you did a lot more with the father figure, his father. It seemed to me that you created more of a moment with that.
Oh, that's interesting. We were very lucky to have Kyle Chandler play the dad.
It's wonderful.
There was actually more there in the book, and we wrote a little more because the dad is only in very short amount of pages in the book and a couple of scenes. And Kyle was amazing to work with, as you would expect if anyone knows his work. Like, I mean, Friday Night Lights, he's incredible. He drove himself from Austin, because he lives here, to Athens, Georgia. It was our little movie. We offered to fly him, and he was like, save your money, I'll drive myself. And he wanted to use the drive to, like, get in character. And he showed up with all these notes. And he really, he's in 6-7 pages of the script. He shot one day.
So, Michael, after Fault in the Stars, which we all know was hugely successful, it really just ignited, I think, an interest in the YA market and the wide audience that a film like that could appeal to. Then John Green, who was involved, you were involved with him in the writing of, I mean, not in the writing, but in some conversations.
I never met him before we wrote Fault in Our Stars. So right. We were hired to write Fault in Our Stars, which Temple Hill, the producers there, and Fox had the rights to the book. My first communication with John was actually after we turned in the first draft. The producers gave John the script, and then he emailed us to say how happy he was. And then he had a few notes, and it was like a lot of notes. But then, which got nervous, it was such a long email. And then we read the email, and it was mostly little things like, because John's brilliant, but not a screenwriter. So his notes were about things like, can we be more specific in scene description that the where they're meeting is in the church basement, the heart of the church. Like there were things like just the way we were describing certain things. And then there were, of course, like a few lines that we had left out that he was like, no, you got to trust me. Like the fans love these lines and certain things like that. But That was our first interaction with John, was an email from him.
Now, after Fault in the Stars, my understanding is that he wrote the first draft of Paper Towns.
The interesting thing for Scott and I is we could not have done Paper Towns first. We had to do Fault in Our Stars first, because with Fault in Our Stars, we were trying to preserve as much of the book as possible. It really was, it was all there. I would say the most significant change we made, and a lot of audiences didn't even pick up on this, and I think enough years have gone by that I can spoil things. When Gus dies in The Fault in Our Stars, there's 45 pages left in the book. And in the book, it feels a little bit like Hazel's going off on another adventure. And the thing about a book, especially such an emotional one like that, is when you experience that those gut punches, you can put the book down and cry, take a walk, come back to it a day later, whenever you want. And obviously, in a movie, you kind of have to know when to get to the curtain. And it felt to us like after Gus dies, it's time to wrap things up. So truncating that last 40-something pages of the book is really the most significant departure we made in the adaptation. And John was so happy with that and really endorsed that, us doing that. And I think that gave us leeway to make much larger changes with Paper Towns. And if you know Paper Towns, the book, the structure is very different than the film.
It was much more challenging, wasn't it, in terms of structure?
There's a road trip in both the book and the film. The kids want to get back for prom. It's the end of the year. It's sort of, things are wrapping up. In the book, prom is in the middle. There's not really any urgency of why they need to get back. In Paper Towns, the main character learns the lesson about how to think about this girl that he's into about a third of the way into the book. And we're like, he has to kind of learn that lesson later on. So I think because John felt so comfortable with how we handled his material the first time, it allowed us on Paper Towns to take more liberties with making sure that it was crafted like a movie and not just exactly what was in the book.
You added a character to the road trip too,
we
right?
We did. We thought Angela, Radar's girlfriend, we loved her. She was awesome. She was sort of, for us, the wisest character in the book, because she was the only person who seemed to know there's more to life than high school, which is also kind of what Shailene's character knew in Spectacular Now. And we thought, wait, this character's amazing. Why does she drop out a third of the way in? She should be on the road trip. So we added her, and John was on board with that as well.
I'm going to do it.
Do it!
Wait, I want to go.
Wait, what?
Well, she's my best friend. I'm going with you.
Okay.
She's going. I'm definitely going, yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Okay.
All right. Radar.
I don't know, guys.
No, come on, come on. If we're all going, let's make this a trip.
What about your parents? What about school?
Parents,
what about
prom?
Oh, who cares about prom?
We're not missing prom.
Okay, fine, we'll get back by prom.
You're really doing this?
And we're doing it now.
Doing it right this damn second.
We got no time to waste, Radar.
Okay.
Yes!
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you think that the fan base gives series more leeway?
For me, my instincts always just run towards film. I want to tell the story once, and I right. certainly don't want to have to make it more than once. Like, that's, oh my God.
It's so hard.
I'm always looking at things from the lens of like, oh, could this be a film? Is my first instinct. And cutting things out and shaving things off, I sort of enjoy that challenge of figuring out, getting to like the real part of the story and what you don't need.
And quite often when you have like a fan base like we have, they'll respond to certain characters or they'll respond to certain storylines. And not always, but sometimes that does influence us in the writer's room. You know, I think, again, John Murphy is a perfect example of that. I mean, he's a brilliant actor and he did great with, you know, the smaller role we had in mind for him, but he just popped with the fans and it was like, okay, this is good. You know, let's give the people what they want. And so it doesn't always happen that we write, you know, towards what they're asking for, but quite often it does influence us.
You know, the Nerdfighters existed, mm-hmm. but I think in some ways Fault in Our Stars was a whole other level because it really became like a mainstream hit book. And in fact, people who otherwise would not have discovered John's earlier novels went back and sort of went through his whole catalog. So we were aware of the fans. You know, it's not like we read Fault in Our Stars and thought, let's set this on the moon. It really, the goal was preserving as much of the book as possible. So we weren't too worried about the fans in terms of like, oh, we're changing things that the fans are going to be upset about.
I've always found it interesting that people or critics will often point to the difficulty of writing teenage characters as if they're aliens from another planet or something, as if they're not flesh and blood human beings. But do you ever feel like you need to research young people in order to write them?
We have a real dialogue with our fans on social media. So we get a lot of feedback and we stay connected that way. But I think, at least for us, we never think of our characters as teenagers first. You know, we think of them as fully dimensionalized characters and fully dimensionalized people. And because we're post-apocalyptic, we aren't readily in those YA situations that you typically see. You know, it's usually like a nuclear, you know, fireball is heading towards you, or, you know, you're in the middle of a sword fight or, you know, something like that. And so it gives us fresh and new ways to explore the YA voice. But for us, it's always about theme and character first. It's not necessarily what would teenagers do. It's sort of putting them in a morally challenging environment and saying, you know, let's explore this as people, not necessarily as teenagers.
It feels like to me that it seems in terms of movies, there's two kinds of YA stories. There are ones that feel a little timeless or out of time. Like The Breakfast Club could be any time. And we tried for that with Spectacular Now. There are some computers and some cell phones, but like very minimal. It does not feel like a specific moment in time. There's almost like a vague 15 years. It could be somewhere in there. But then you watch something like Clueless, right? And Clueless is like very specifically a specific moment in time, it feels like.
And super awesome.
Incredible. but what I want to say is this, like regardless of whether or not it's like super specific to a specific time, the way Clueless or Fast Times at Ridgemont High feels very specific to a time, or it's a little timeless or out of time, like Breakfast Club or Spectacular Now, the emotions of what the characters are going through, that's the part that it doesn't matter if you are a teen now, you were just a teen a few years ago, or you were a teen 50 years ago. That stuff has to be the stuff that all of us went through coming of age. So as long as the emotions are legitimate and come from a real place, that to me is the most important thing when doing YA.
On Story is brought to you in part by the Alice Kleberg Reynolds Foundation, a Texas family providing innovative funding since 1979. This project is supported in part by the Cultural Arts Division of the City of Austin Economic Development Department, the Texas Commission on the Arts, the U.S. Institute of Museum and Library Services, and Texas Library and Archives Commission. This program is also made possible in part by a grant from Humanities Texas, the state affiliate for the National Endowment for the Humanities. The show is produced by myself, Barbara Morgan. Our associate producers are Colin Heyer, Sonia McCarter, and Maya Perez. Our editors are Jamal Knox and Travis Neely. Music by Brian Ramos. Production assistance comes from The Sound Lab, Inc. and KUT 90.5 in Austin. Go to austinfilmfestival.com to find out more about Austin Film Festival and Conference each October. Until next time, I'm Barbara Morgan, and this has been Austin Film Festival's On Story.
PRI, Public Radio International.